Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing rift between President-elect Trump and the intelligence community following the release of a devastating dossier on Trump's potential for alleged blackmail, and the testimony today from Trump's nominee to head up the CIA, Congressman Pompeo. A veteran CIA operative, Robert Baer, who is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN, joins us to discuss whether Trump and his new CIA director, who does not believe in global warming, could construct their own facts and operate in an alternative universe while the rest of the world continues to convulse and erupt with daily outbursts of reality, many of which result in incidents or events that require understanding, if not attention, and happen independently from whatever dogma or ideology presidents and congressmen might be informed by. Then we'll speak with a leading analyst of national security and executive power, David Rothkopf, the CEO and editor of the FP Group and publisher of Foreign Policy Magazine and foreignpolicy.com, the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. His latest book is National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. And we will discuss his latest article at Foreign Policy, There is a Cure for Fake News and Dangerous Leadership, and how thin the support is amongst Republicans on Capitol Hill for the erratic, insecure, and unqualified president about to be inaugurated. Then finally, we will explore the peculiar symmetry between elements on the American left and the right who resist or dismiss the growing weight of evidence of Russia's meddling in our election and the very real possibility that Trump has been compromised by Putin. John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, joins us to discuss his latest article, The Russian Honeypot: Russia Has Big Plans for Donald Trump, and Why Leftists Who Should Be Alarmed by Trump's Fascist Tendencies Make Excuses for the Authoritarian Bromance Between Trump and Putin. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's currently the National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN, and his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
And I guess we're all waiting to see this tape, or now the BBC is reporting that there's more than one tape, compromising tapes of Donald Trump's alleged sexual hijinks in Moscow. Do you think this evidence will ever see the light of day?
You know, look, Moscow, all the major hotels are wired for both sound and visual. It's fiber optics. Ritz-Carlton presidential suite. They've got fiber optics in there, and they take pictures of basically everybody. So if indeed Trump went into that room and misbehaved, they'd have a tape of it. The thing is that they just don't let these things out. I mean, it's for the Russians, this is top secret. I think that if Trump crossed Russia in some way or was forced to take some anti-Russian measure, they would pull it out to weaken his presidency, if indeed a tape exists. And that's when we'll see it.
So,
you know,
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, apparently there were three requests to the FISA court to look into electronic back channels through Alpha Bank and another bank, between the Kremlin and the Trump campaign. First two were rejected by FISA judges. They went to a third judge and apparently got it approved. And there's speculation that one of the people named in it was Donald Trump. Do you think that there will be any real inquiries into, since now it's the press obviously have this situation where it's not invented here, so both the New York Times and the Washington Post, and except for CNN, everybody seems to be dismissing this report, even though it was considered credible enough for the CIA to include it in a briefing to both President-elect Trump and President Obama.
Well, that's what makes it really, and of course, is the fact that the FBI asked for FISA. That's not the CIA. These people don't really joke around. I mean, they need evidence before they're going to go for a FISA. It's very rare just to do this on a whim, and I don't think they did. And I think the fact that the CIA and the FBI went to Obama and Trump with this report gives it credibility. Before, I've heard of this stuff in the hotel for almost a year now. I didn't necessarily believe it. But when you have at that level and people willing to put it on paper, it tells a different story. If they had considered this just some sort of base rumor, they would have transmitted orally, probably to Flynn, the National Security Advisor designate, or even Trump himself, to, hey, Mr. President-elect, these rumors are going around. We just want you to know we're obligated. He would have said thank you. The fact they put it down on paper tells me either that the intelligence community is out to get Trump, which is sort of unimaginable, or they have basis to think it's real.
Well, subsequently, of course, in his press conference, he accused the intelligence community of behaving like Nazis, and he already mischaracterized the conversation that the DNI General Clapper had with him, suggesting that there was nobody inside the intelligence community that leaked this dossier. It had been around forever. Any number of people could have leaked it, including the person who's commissioned to do it, Christopher Steele, the MI6 former officer, who, by the way, was the head of the Russian desk at MI6 and their top undercover operative in the London embassy, the Moscow embassy of Britain. So I take it one of the reasons why the intelligence community here in the United States take this report seriously is because they take him seriously. They think he's credible.
They do take him seriously, and he's provided evidence to the FBI, which turned out to be correct, that they've used for convictions in FIFA. No, I mean, the guy is totally credible, everything I've seen on him. But more than that, you go back to the Alpha Bank, and there's encrypted communications with the Trump campaign that the New York Times was waved off of this story by the Department of Justice. There's a standing policy at the Department of Justice to keep out any indication of foreign influence in the elections before the elections. I think that was probably going to turn out to be a mistake, but that was their policy right up until November. So, I mean, I think what we need now is to go back and look at those encrypted communications. Look what kind of messages were passed between the Trump campaign and Moscow. And revisit this whole Russian thing, because it's just beggars the imagination why Trump, in the face of everybody saying the Russians hacked the election, it still supports Putin. I mean, this is just, it's nutty. It's Mad Max world.
Well, what did you make of the testimony today of Congressman Pompeo, who's Trump's nominee for to head up the CIA? He was asked about whether he would stand up to Trump. The real question should be, will these investigations underway, will they proceed or will they be stopped or will they be ignored?
I think they'll be ignored. You know, it's very easy to take intelligence and make it disappear. Very easy. I just can't see a CIA director actively going after the president of the United States. It's never happened before, except Watergate. But that was a special case, and I don't see how it works. I don't see how it works that a president is fighting against the CIA and the FBI and the National Security Agency
and the press.
It's never happened in our history ever.
Right.
So, if I had told you this was going to happen a year ago, you would have just unplugged your phone and not talked to me ever again.
Well, what's your sense, though, of Pompeo doesn't believe in global warming, which is pretty scary. But by and large, in the testimony that I saw today, he seemed reasonable. He's sort of billed as a Tea Party ideologue, and he was one of these congressmen who were beating the drum on Benghazi when there was no there. What did you make of him, his testimony, and his possible appointment?
His testimony was tailored, the shape to get through the process in Congress. He knows where the votes are. He couldn't get up in front of Congress and say Russia's not a threat or this hacking didn't exist. I mean, it would just... but the fact that he went after Benghazi, Clinton, which is clearly... There's no there. I mean, there was no scandal. And his continuing to push for this tells me he's an ideologue. And he's not going to go with the facts. I mean, but again, we're just going to have to wait and see. We're getting so many contradictory signals. Or the fact that Tillerson, the Secretary of State nominee, hasn't been coordinating the Russian issue with Trump. It's like no one's talking to each other. I mean, where does this all go? And I don't know. Nobody knows. It'll change from day to day.
Well, I think the more you find out about Trump, the less there is there. I think he's being closeted. And I think the reason he lashes out all the time, particularly the intelligence community, is that he simply doesn't know anything. And he has to dominate. You know, he's got this out of control ego and this alpha male attitude on steroids.
Oh, I think so. He's, you know, narcissistic. He's gaslighting or whatever. What psychological terms we're using today is sort of irrelevant. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't have the temperament to be president. And what we have to hope for is the people around him sort of corral him in the Oval Office. And I'm, you know, Mattis in particular, Secretary of Defense, nominated for it, is another one that has to. And, you know, the fact is that we have to look to Lindsey Graham and John McCain for adult supervision in all of this. And we just have to, or even Rubio, we have to support them as they fight back. I mean, to talk about, you know, we need bipartisan support for these people that are introducing some sort of reason and logic into running this country. Otherwise, we are going to meet with a disaster.
Well, just in the last minute, your organization, the one that you are a national security affairs analyst for, CNN, they took a hit at the, at least their national security correspondent. He took a real hit at the press conference. And of course, Trump had his cheer squad there cheering Trump and booing Jim Schutte. So.
Well, I mean, it's, come on, you know, the CNN, once you got that piece of a briefing of the president, and Trump, that Trump had been compromised, that's what journalists do. They report on. They didn't comment on the veracity of the report. They just said he was briefed on it.
Right.
Well, perfectly reasoned, you know, piece of reporting. So, I mean, and the fact that he attacks CNN is just tells me the man is very insecure.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. And he is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a leading analyst of national security and executive power.
You really are, then you won't be laughing so hard. No, you won't be laughing so
hard. Walk away now, and you're gonna start a war. We expected something better than before. We expected something.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, the CEO and editor of the FP Group, publisher of Foreign Policy magazine, foreignpolicy.com, and presenter of FP Events. He is a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and is the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. And his latest book is National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. And his latest article at Foreign Policy is There is a Cure for Fake News and Dangerous Leaders. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Good to be back.
And you quote in your article, There is a Cure for Fake News and Dangerous Leaders, Rudyard Kipling, if you can keep your head when all around you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, and so forth. I must say that sort of rings. Do you think that would apply to the director of national intelligence who felt compelled to call Donald Trump yesterday after he had trashed the intelligence community and charged them with leaking something which they I don't think they did leak, and certainly the DNI said they didn't leak it, and among other things likened them to Nazi Germany?
Yes, I think Clapper maintained his head. I think he has consistently, I think, throughout this, displayed a kind of cool and respect for the facts that is essential in these areas. The documents that were leaked have actually been floating around in journalistic circles for months and months. They floated to John McCain, who gave them to the FBI a couple months ago. So they've clearly been out there in the private sector for a long time. And I think the intelligence community came to the conclusion that because there was a possibility that they would leak, it was time for a heads up. And I think they did Trump service. And I think once again, what Trump did was he threw them under the bus. He attacked them. He shot the messenger and then proceeded to once again defend the Russians and even go a step further and hide behind their skirts by saying, oh, the Russians said none of this is true. But which, you know, oddly enough, they said, because they would, of course, deny it.
So I think watching that rather strange press conference with his Donald Trump's cheer squad on the side, etc., in spite of the fact that it's an extraordinary situation to have somebody that in the very rare moments where he even talked about policy, he clearly is out of his depth and doesn't appear to know what he's talking about. Nevertheless, I think it was a major, major success with his followers. They hate the press. They love him. So how do we navigate forward with somebody that has such a is appealing in such a different way to an angry and an alienated base, at the same time remind ourselves that this is a minority president?
Well, yeah, let's start with the fact that more than 75% of the American people didn't vote for Trump. Because half of them didn't vote, and the majority of those that did vote didn't vote for him. So, you know, we talk a lot about this base of his, but this base is a small minority of Americans. Secondly, a lot of the people that do support Trump, or at least apparently support Trump at the moment in the institutional world of the Republican Party, will discard him the moment he becomes too toxic for their futures. And we need to remember that the Congress has an election in 2 years in which everybody in the House of Representatives and a third of the people in the Senate are up for re-election. And so the closer we get to that election, the closer they're going to be looking at whether or not close affiliation to Donald Trump is in their interest or not. If it's not, you know, they'll toss him under the bus in 2 seconds. I don't care how many people are cheering for him in his, you know, West Wing press room. You know, you think Paul Ryan cares whether he's dealing with Donald Trump or Mike Pence as the president of the United States? Of course not. In fact, he likes Pence more, I'm sure. So Trump needs to be aware that he's on pretty thin ice with every major sort of source of institutional support he's got. He's on thin ice with the American public. And, of course, Vladimir Putin will toss him to the wolves the second it suits Vladimir Putin to do that. So, you know, he appears kind of strong, but it's a Potemkin support. And what he's doing now is laying the groundwork for the future problems he's likely to face.
And again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who's the CEO and editor of the FP Group, publisher of Foreign Policy Magazine, foreignpolicy.com, and presenter of FP Events. He is a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and his latest book is National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear, and his latest article at Foreign Policy is There is a Cure for Fake News and Dangerous Leaders. So given that it appears, at least to me, that he's way out of his depth and is in many ways closeted, and I think there is a big curtain around him that his handlers have drawn. He's even using his own private security. He doesn't trust the Secret Service. He's alienated the intelligence community. I don't know whether you watched the hearings for the Congressman Pompeo today to be the new head of the CIA. He certainly had a reputation as a Tea Party spear thrower with inflaming the non-existent Benghazi scandal. But nevertheless, he seemed actually quite rational to me. What was your take on it?
I think for the most part, he seemed quite rational. He's a smart guy. He well-educated, seen as a professional by many people, defended the intelligence community. I think it was quite interesting the degree and the vehemence with which he defended the intelligence community, incoming Secretary of Defense. Mattis defended the intelligence community. Even Rex Tillerson defended the intelligence community, all contrary to the assertions of Trump. By the way, they also attacked Russia, contrary to the policies of Trump, which suggests a level of coordination that seems to be missing in the midst of all this. Now, having said that, you know, Pompeo's a little kooky on some issues, and, you know, he refused to comment on whether he not thought that climate change was real. And, you know, there are those of us out there who believe in science and recognize that climate change may dislocate populations and change global power and resources around the world for the next several decades, and thus is actually a national security issue. So it's a little scary to have somebody in a senior position who's, you know, a science denier, but, you know, for the most part, he was certainly better than his boss.
But given that you, David Rothkopf, have really studied the structures of power, particularly in terms of national security, where you have this key role of the National Security Advisor, and you've talked to, I think, all of the living National Security Advisors before the book you did, Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, with somebody that appears to be out of his depth and believes in strange conspiracy theories. I don't know whether you know about the incident with the head of the National Security Agency, who Mike Flynn set up a meeting with him. He was the first person to meet with Donald Trump after Trump's election night celebration the very next day. And he went there to get the DNI's job, so he was auditioning. And then Trump starts to ask him about Benghazi and why are you guys at the NSA covering up Benghazi? And then he gets into a screaming match with him and throws him out. So I'm not sure what Trump believes, but given my doubts about whether he's up for the job, given that situation, surely you need adult supervision at that very key position of the National Security Advisor. And in this case, General Mike Flynn is something of a conspiracy theorist too, is he not?
Yeah, no, I mean, he's a lousy choice for the job. And of course, one of his deputies, Monica Crowley, is now embroiled in multiple plagiarism scandals. Another of his deputies, KT McFarland, although she has some National Security Council experience, primarily been a Fox commentator, as was Monica Crowley over the years. The White House staff is quite weak. Grant Priebus, the chief of staff, is somebody who's never had any executive branch experience in the U.S. government. Has never really managed anything akin to the White House. Obviously, the U.S. government's the largest, most complex organization on the planet Earth. President's not going to manage it on a day-to-day basis. Chief staff's a really important job, and he doesn't have the depth there. He's got people like Steve Bannon down the hall, who is, you know, used to run Breitbart, you know, a kind of nationalist, racist media outlet, and so that's a little bit frightening. He's just appointed as an advisor Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, who has, you know, no government experience, foreign policy experience, you know, chops to speak of. Et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I mean, you've got a very kind of weak management team in the White House. You've got some strong people at different cabinet agencies and also some astonishingly weak people at some cabinet agencies. And then within the structure, you've also got some weird stuff where they're like proliferating White House counsels left and right. There's multiple senior advisors. They've added an international trade council. There's now four people in the U.S. government, a negotiator, an international trade council head, the United States trade representative, and the Secretary of Commerce, all of whom think they're going to be negotiating trade deals. And the president-elect has no experience managing this kind of organization. I think he's setting it up akin to his past experience as a kind of a loose holding company. And, you know, that works if the holding companies themselves are well managed. Some of these will be, some of these won't be. There's already infighting between Mattis and Flynn on important personnel and policy issues. So, you know, my sense is, you know, one of the unexpected surprises for Trump and some of his supporters who sort of said, hey, it's a businessman, he knows how to manage things, is that he actually doesn't know how to manage things. And the White House and the administration is going to be a kind of a dangerous mishmash, fraught with divisions and petty battles between the fiefdoms.
And in terms of your article at Foreign Policy, David Rothkopf, there is a cure for fake news and dangerous leaders. We've certainly discussed the dangerous leader, and he hasn't even begun to lead. And I must say, it's a startling contrast between the outgoing president, who had 8 years of scandal-free White House and has very, very high ratings, and I think is beloved by a lot of Americans, to contrast him, his outgoing administration, with this incoming that's sort of tainted by scandal from this this dossier, to say the least, along with potential for scandal because he won't really divest himself of his businesses and says that somehow there's a wall between him and his sons who'll be running the business, which he will still own. The idea that they'd be sitting down at the dinner table, the family, and not discuss what the boys are up to is just ridiculous. So, you know, so we have a potential for endless scandals going in. So do you see this as a rather sad comparison?
Oh, yeah. That's a rhetorical question.
I mean, it's a loaded question.
Yeah, it's just, of course it's a sad comparison. I mean, look, Barack Obama was far from a perfect president. He had a kind of lousy foreign policy record, as far as I'm concerned. The dignity that we appreciate about him also is a result of his being very conservative and circumspect, which led him not to take action in places like Syria, which have caused enormous human tragedy and also real blows to American interests. He has been an enabler of the rise of Putin in places like Ukraine and in Syria. And so I think, you know, Obama, for all of his decency as a human being and some of his real achievements on the domestic front, has had some flaws as a leader. But, you know, I'll take him any day of the week over Trump, who not only has no experience and terrible ideas and bad instincts and, you know, flawed character and not a terribly good brain, a lousy group of advisors around him, but the man has zero ethical standards. You know, you talked about this conflict of interest thing, the notion that somehow, you know, well, I'll hand over the business to my sons. It's still going to be called the Trump Organization. I'm still going to own it. And certainly if I took certain kinds of actions, it's, you know, could have a lasting effect on my net worth and that of my family, when I leave office. You know, that's just ridiculous. It doesn't even pass the laugh test. He hasn't had some of his cabinet nominees deal with the Office of Government Ethics. He has cabinet officers. He's got more cabinet officers who have been nominated or advisors who have been nominated who have had spouse abuse charges than he has women in his cabinet. The list goes on and on and on. You know, he's going to continue, you know, being the executive producer of a reality show. He appointed a head of a wrestling organization as the head of the Small Business Administration. He's got a right-wing nut who's going to go and send off to Israel to be the ambassador to Israel and promote the nuttiest of right-wing policies there. You know, he's got a racist attorney general coming in who wants to undercut voting rights. He's got a a Secretary of Education who wants to get rid of the Department of Education, a Secretary of Energy who doesn't know anything about energy or nuclear weapons, who wanted to get rid of the Department of Education, a Secretary of Labor who doesn't actually believe in labor organizations and whose organization is rife with reports of sexual harassment and other forms of labor abuse. The list goes on and on and on. You know, you want a scandal. You can't throw a stone and not hit somebody in Washington associated with Trump who isn't rife, open to some kind of major scandal. So, you know, some people think this guy is Teflon and, you know, none of this stuff sticks to him because his base is so solid. Well, it doesn't matter what his base is. It matters what's in the interests of the people who run the committees that do the investigations. And right now it's in their interest to support him. But when they get closer to their own reelection, it may not be. And at that point, he's in trouble.
But in terms of how one deals with fake news, I just want to touch on this before we end, because it's such an extraordinary issue. And by the way, President Obama in his farewell address dealt with it at length, in the sense that we have become a society that does its own reality shopping, that we're all retreating into our own political silos, and the Christians get their news from Christian media, liberals from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox, and there's no longer a consensus about what is real and true, and certainly not any respect for science on the right. As you mentioned, the incoming head of the CIA doesn't even believe in global warming, which is extremely alarming. But there is a bit of a history with the way that the Trump people have used fake news. After all, they went after Facebook, realizing it 2/3 to 3/4 of Americans get their news from Facebook. They intimidated Zuckerberg into getting rid of the human creation under the canard that there was a liberal bias that allowed fake news to infiltrate Facebook. And now they put a very conservative journalist in to be the human curator. So it seems that the Trump people are pretty proactive in the use of social media and the recognition of how powerful it is as a platform for information.
Look, I think Donald Trump is an idiot and a dangerous man. I don't want to, you know, mince words about it. This guy's a terrible choice for president. It's bad news for the United States of America. You know, every once in a while, blind squirrel finds a nut. And Donald Trump stumbled, mainly probably for bad reasons. He doesn't read stuff, and he's got a short attention span and so forth, into using social media in a certain kind of way. And it enabled him to bypass the Republican National Committee in the early stages of the primaries, not require a big infrastructure, build a base of millions of people, communicate with them on a basis that actually made him feel more intimately connected to his constituents, his base, than other politicians did. Did it because he's got such a kind of a flair for the outrageous. He did it in a way that attracted more and more attention and led him to go viral. He's got a kind of a innate gift for virality, and all of that led him to be the perfect candidate for the era of what I call the double echo chamber, which is not just social media or Facebook. And the echo chamber that we have in Washington. But most people now get their news, as you say, from Facebook, and the stuff that appears on their wall or the stuff that gets retweeted to them comes from friends they've chosen, and their friends tend to post stuff that their other friends will like. And so you live in a bubble of the news that your friends select, not that editors select. And people tend to be like-minded, and so they hear the same thing over and over again. And so, you know, if all you're reading is Breitbart, then you start thinking Breitbart is the truth, even though it's not the truth. And Trump has relied on that very well thus far, including on this Russia thing, where, you know, he tweeted out, I have no deals in Russia. I have no loans in Russia. I have no ties to Russia. When, in fact, none of that is true. And, he must know none of that is true, but he realizes that it doesn't matter. When Clapper, you know, issued his statement about the dossier on Trump, Trump's response was, see, Clapper said that this, you know, dossier was a lie. Well, Clapper didn't say that. But right. Trump, you know, sort of knows that within his community, he's going to get away with it. The problem is that community only takes you so far. And we're getting up to that point. Because now, as president, Trump depends on the rest of the Washington apparatus to work with him. And if he alienates the IC, the intelligence community, they're going to leak, and they'll start blowing him up. And if he alienates the Congress and stuff comes up about him, they will go after him, and they will investigate him. And if he alienates our allies overseas, they will go after him, and they will be harder to deal with. And there's a whole bunch of people out there that don't give a hoot about his base. And so that's why I think, at the end of the day, truth will ultimately triumph and will be the most powerful tool that those who fear Trump can use in order to rein him in.
Well, David Rothkopf, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's a CEO and editor of the FP Group, publisher of Foreign Policy Magazine, foreignpolicy.com, and presenter of FP Events. He is a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and is the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. And his latest book is National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. And his latest article at Foreign Policy is There is a Cure for Fake News and Dangerous Leaders. We're going to take a brief station break and be back exploring the peculiar symmetry between elements on the American left and the right who resist or dismiss the growing weight of evidence of Russian meddling in our elections and the very real possibility that Trump has been compromised by Putin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously, he worked as an associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Services Committee. His books include Power Trip, U.S. Unilateralism and Global Strategy After September 11, Crusade 2.0, and his latest book is Splinterlands. And he has an article at Foreign Policy and Focus, The Russian Honeypot, Russia Has Had Big Plans for Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Pfeffer.
Thanks for having me back.
And John, the article that I mentioned, the Russian Honeypot, you wrote it apparently a week or so ago, and it was published on the weekend in a Korean newspaper, and this before this bombshell broke of the dossier, which made Donald Trump quite angry at his recent and rare press conference, at which he blamed the CIA, the intelligence community, called them a bunch of behaving like Nazis. And subsequently, of course, the director of national intelligence has tried to calm him down and explain that the leak did not come from the intelligence community, which is it's likely it came from, since it's been distributed pretty widely for the last several months, it probably came from other sources, or even Christopher Steele, the MI6 officer himself, who compiled the report. Let's begin with your response to the report, because it's got the press all indignant about how dare somebody release unsubstantiated information, even though this was included, or at least a digest of it, it was included in the CIA briefing or intelligence community briefing to both President Obama and President-elect, and that this MI6 officer has apparently a very good reputation within the American intelligence community, and they have high confidence in his product. So what's your response?
Well, I think that the Russian government probably has some kind of dossier on Donald Trump, just as it has dossiers on all major American political figures. It's, of course, interested in not only influencing American politicians, but trying to get an edge on them somehow, and whatever information they can dig up is going to be useful. This particular dossier has some explosive, to say the least, allegations. And to be very honest with you, the kind of major one, which involves a rather peculiar sexual practice that Donald Trump allegedly engaged in a Moscow hotel, doesn't strike me as probable. And the reason why is because, Donald Trump is a notorious germaphobe. I mean, he doesn't even like to shake hands with people. And that doesn't prevent him, of course, from engaging in all sorts of sexual dalliances in the past with all sorts of people. And God knows how those take place between a germaphobe and a non-germaphobe. But in any case, the particular sexual practice that they mentioned seems so highly unlikely for a germaphobe to engage in, that I doubt that would be the one that he would be involved in. Nevertheless, I do think that the Russian government has something on Donald Trump, just as they had something on Hillary Clinton through the hacking of the Democratic Party emails. I think that the honey trap or the honey pot is best understood more metaphorically than literally when it comes to Donald Trump's relationship with the Russian government.
But what I don't understand is this peculiar alliance on the left and on the right in this country. You're with the Institute for Policy Studies, which is considered a left-wing think tank, and I get nothing but angry mail from what people who watch RT, Russia Today, and call you a warmonger if you say anything bad about Vladimir Putin. And of course, Donald Trump and the far right, Fox News, they recently had a love fest with Julian Assange, Sean Hannity did. So it feels like all of our kind of political lines that were drawn up through the Cold War and afterwards have been not just crossed, but have become very confusing.
Indeed. I mean, it is extraordinary that a figure today, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, who has been very clear that he espouses very conservative political views, and one could even call them extreme right-wing views, and those include his xenophobia, his anti-immigrant sentiment, his anti-human rights sentiment, his positions in which he has basically called for Russia to lead a kind of Christian crusade against Islam, against particular representations of Islam, like the Islamic State, and his willingness to partner with extreme right-wing parties in Europe, National Front in France, Marine Le Pen, Viktor Orban's Fidesz in Hungary, the UKIP in the UK, all because, from his point of view, not only do they share kind of similar right-wing positions, but they're all against the European Union for a variety of reasons. But here is a man who has taken all of those positions, and yet for some bizarre reason, and we can come up with some explanations, but for some bizarre reason, there is a cadre of leftists in the United States and elsewhere that still see Putin and Russia somehow as this important geopolitical counterforce and as a kind of a symbol for resistance to imperialism and representing somehow left values. That, to me, is incomprehensible.
But if Putin were to be described in the American political context, there's probably nobody that has so much blood on his hands in American politics. You know, he's a mass murderer. But in terms of his particular politics, he would make Rick Santorum look like a libertine. I mean, let me just quote from a 2013 speech where Vladimir Putin, it's in your article, where he chastised the Euro-Atlantic countries for, quote, rejecting their roots, including the Christian values that constitute the basis of Western civilization. They are denying moral principles and all traditional identities, national, cultural, religious, and even sexual. They are implementing policies that equate large families with same-sex partnerships, belief in God with the belief in Satan. And then he went on to excoriate political correctness and unlawful immigration, which certainly has echoes of Donald Trump, and concludes this by saying one must respect every minority's right to be different, but the rights of the majority must not be put in question. Of course, he goes much further in suggesting that anybody that is liberal and pro-Western in Russia today are a fifth column. Right there on the steps of the Kremlin, his main political opponent was murdered just before he's about to release a report on the Russian military casualties inside Ukraine, a war that they weren't supposed to be fighting. So I find it pretty extraordinary that, I'm absolutely overwhelmed by relentless phishing scams from Russian hackers. I can't barely find listener responses because of hundreds of Russian emails every day. So what's going on here? It seems like RT is not really trying to reach an American audience so much as influencing the American left.
Yeah, I mean, the RT's audience is not huge. It doesn't have the kind of reach that, you know, BBC would have or even some of the, you know, larger kind of alternative websites here in the United States. But it has been extraordinarily successful in cultivating connections with the American left, not only bringing folks onto their show. And here I have to admit, I've been on shows, on RT shows, to talk about specific issues like military spending and what have you. But it's also kind of sucked up American journalists who have been set adrift from other mainstream outlets, people like Larry King and Tom Hartman. You know, these are not necessarily far leftists. Certainly Larry King is not. But RT is very kind of astute in seeing an opportunity to cultivate ties with what amounts to an American intelligentsia. And, you know, and judging by the kind of positive press that Putin and Russia has gotten from the left here, not the entire left, but key kind of, websites and intellectuals, their investment has paid off.
Well, Larry King was paid $250,000 by, I'm not sure it came directly from RT or from a Russian oligarch, to say nice things about Putin's guy in Ukraine before he was toppled. So there you have it. Again, I'm speaking with John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, whose latest book is Splinterlands, and he has an article in Foreign Policy and Focus, The Russian Honeypot. Russia has had big plans for Donald Trump. So what's your understanding then of why Donald Trump goes through such hoops and such mental gymnastics to continue to say nice things about Vladimir Putin? Even yesterday in the press conference, he said he was very impressed with the fact that Putin rejected the dossier and these claims about the honey trap and et cetera, mm-hmm. which, of course, naturally he would reject them because they point the finger mm-hmm. at him. But, you know, it seems pretty obvious to a lot of people that Putin helped elect Trump. I mean, there are other reasons, Hillary Clinton's appalling campaign, the letter from the FBI director, et cetera, why Trump won. But nevertheless, if you add up all of the fact that RT was the first to release the existence of Hillary Clinton's server, which dogged her throughout the campaign, the hacking of the DNC, the hacking of John Podesta, the fake news, et cetera, all of that cumulatively obviously had an effect. So are we just going to go through this sort of thuggish denial forever in this man? He's not even a president yet.
And at the very least, you can make the case if Vladimir Putin wanted to weaken America and undermine American confidence in its democratic structures, then he's already won.
Yes. Well, I don't think it's inevitable. I mean, you know, there could be a very prominent falling out between Putin and Trump within a couple of weeks of inauguration. It's always possible. But I think there are three reasons why Trump has cultivated or reciprocated in this relationship. The first is Putin very astutely appealed to Trump's vanity. Anybody who wants to influence Donald Trump has to first begin by saying that the man is great, the man is the best. And Putin, of course, played into that. The second is pure opportunism. The Obama administration and Hillary Clinton as the Secretary of State could be blamed for a major deterioration in relations between the United States and Russia. So here was an opportunity to kind of say, hey, you know, I can do much better than either Clinton or Obama. I can appeal directly to Vladimir Putin. We have a relationship. That's the way foreign policy is going to work in my administration. So that's the second. And then the third would be, of course, the ideological connections. I mean, as you said, you read that selection from Putin's speech in 2013. Each one of those elements that Putin identifies corresponds to an element in Donald Trump's campaign, both for the Republican nomination and in the presidential campaign. And you know, there is definitely an ideological affinity between the two, and it goes beyond their preference for the concentration of power, their contempt for democracy, their contempt for civil society, their oligarchic predispositions. It goes beyond that to actual ideological affinity. And I mean, it's hard to talk about ideology when it comes to Donald Trump because, to a certain extent, you know, he is malleable. He has switched his positions over the years pretty much across the board. But if we're talking about a governing ideology that is being shaped as we speak, that is being put together as part of his cabinet appointees, an ideology that will influence his first 18 months in power, then yes, there is definitely an affinity between what Putin has identified as the key themes behind Russian foreign policy and what Donald Trump imagines will make America great in his term of office.
Well, I think he's already weakened America and will continue to do so. And again, that might well be Putin's reward. But my sense is that this is a very weak man underneath all of this bluster and showmanship. He clearly doesn't have a clue about what he's doing. I mean, when he starts to talk about policy, which he rarely does, in that press conference, he barely touched on it. But when he did about repealing the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, he made absolutely no sense. So, you know, I think that he's being closeted by a group of people who have jumped on his bandwagon, and most of all the vice president, who's, and the Republicans in general have gotten power via his election. So they're just thrilled. I don't even know that they need him anymore. But that's what most worries me about this man, is that he just seems so completely out to lunch, and that he could be and is likely extremely susceptible to being manipulated.
That is true. I would definitely agree with you that, you know, from the point of view of, you know, his intellectual bona fides, you know, they practically don't exist. And anybody who spends so much time trumpeting their own virtues, their own greatness, well, and obviously is masking a great internal insecurity. However, his greatest strength, from my point of view, is his willingness to break rules. He has absolutely no interest in following either the guidelines that have been laid down as part of tradition or following the advice of, you know, the gray eminences in Washington, D.C. He is interested only in pursuing power, his own power personally and the power of his associates through the flouting of rules. And to a certain extent, that you can find a parallel there with Putin as well. Putin, you know, certainly is has not shown any interest in kind of adhering to the rule of law within Russia itself. You alluded to, you know, the assassination of his opponents. He's certainly thrown many of them in jail. He showed great ruthlessness in Chechnya and bombing campaign in Syria. Certainly showed no interest in rule of law in Ukraine. So there, I think the two, again, have a shared perspective. And, you know, as long as that flouting of the rules is accepted and even to a certain extent praised, because here in the United States, when Trump is politically incorrect or when he does something like accepts a phone call from Taiwan, that is praised in many sectors as being refreshing, as being, you know, upending the status quo. As long as that continues to be accepted and applauded, then he will continue to be strong from that point of view. Remove that, and it can be removed from one day to the next through the exposure of malfeasance of an enormous degree that cannot be accepted, then that power is eliminated. But it from my point of view, it has little to do with his intelligence. It has everything to do with his willingness to break the rules.
Well, indeed, that press conference yesterday, which I thought was an absolute circus with his cheer squad of his supporters on the side cheering when they agreed with questions and booing when they didn't, and the whole presentation is completely bizarre. But his takedown of the press and his going toe-to-toe with them, the CNN reporter in particular, I bet you his supporters just love it.
And
there's been clear in evidence that almost all of his supporters don't think that any of this Russian stuff is a big deal. They don't seem to mind that this guy could be Putin's bitch. You know, it's just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
But just in closing, there is a majority of Americans who oppose this guy. What the hell are they going to do?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's obviously a lot of opportunities for resistance over the next 4 years. And, you know, I think some people see that resistance as being at the national level here in Washington, D.C. I don't see much, you know, of a future for that. I mean, we'll get the first evidence when the nominees sail to confirmation, and I think most of them, virtually all of them, will. And we'll see confirmation of that when some of the key elements of Trump's agenda, whether it's building a wall with or without Mexican monetary support, and, you know, getting rid of Obamacare, sail through one way or the other Congress. From my point of view, the resistance that will be most effective will take place at a state and local level. That's where, you know, there's greater concentration of antipathy toward Donald Trump and what he stands for. And I think greater opportunity to really throw sand into the mechanisms, if you will, of the Trump machine.
Well, John Pfeffer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And again, I've been speaking with John Pfeffer, who's the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously worked as associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. And his latest book is Splinterlands, and his latest article at Foreign Policy and Focus is The Russian Honeypot. Russia has had big plans for Donald Trump. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.